I'm Peter King, and I represent Midwest Gas Storage and Midwest Gas Services, Inc. May it please the court. In 1989, my clients purchased a gas storage field located in Brazil, Indiana. It was strategically located between two interstate pipelines, Panhandle Eastern and Texas Gas. My clients offered their gas storage field to customers in that market to store gas when prices were cheap and to take that gas out when prices were higher during times of constraint, and they did that. They also had a plan to hook up their storage field and their facilities to both interstate pipelines. They were going to do that because it was going to obviously make them money, but also provide a benefit to the marketplace because historically there is a price differential between the gas coming in on those two interstate pipelines. The defendant's conduct prevented my client's plan from coming to fruition. Now, the district court orders dismissing our complaint should be reversed and remanded because the district court erred in relying upon the Indiana Supreme Court case in the USG situation, in USG case, and in finding that the plaintiffs did not adequately plead antitrust injury and antitrust standing, and because the court relied upon the Sixth Circuit decision in the INDEC case. I'd like to first address the USG case. The district court's decision to treat the USG case was erroneous because that court's decision was based on an IURC order. The IURC, the Indiana Regulatory Commission, does not have antitrust jurisdiction. That jurisdiction lies exclusively here in the federal court. The IURC did not undertake any sort of antitrust analysis. That regulatory body did not concern itself whether the defendants suppressed the development of this independent gas storage field in this market, or whether they did not look at the impact of ProAlliance hoarding the interstate transportation on the interstate pipelines in question. The decision was also preliminary. That case went to hearing after a short period of time after ProAlliance was created. So they had about 6 months of history when they went to hearing. It was approximately April through October of 1996. That period did not even include any of the winter months where there were potentially times of constraint and times of abuse possible. The district court further erred in relying upon the USG case because courts cannot take notice, judicial notice, of findings of fact from other proceedings for the truth of the matter asserted, and that's what the court did. Certainly the court could not rely upon the doctrine of collateral estoppel because my client wasn't a party to the IURC proceeding. So for those reasons, the court's reliance, the district court's reliance on the USG case was erroneous. Now the court further erred in finding that there was no antitrust injury or antitrust standing because we adequately pled antitrust injury and standing. And first let me address the injury point. We've alleged in the First Amendment complaint, which is the complaint that's at issue, we've alleged how there was a storage field that we were developing in this market and how it would have allowed consumers to benefit in the market because they would be able to hedge against higher prices by storing gas in the summer, for example, and taking the gas out during the winter months. We've alleged that in paragraphs 11 and 14 of the First Amendment complaint.
Let me just stop you there. How do you respond to the point that your analysis of the effect on prices or output overlooks the capacity available from sources other than ProAlliance?
Well, I think we addressed that in that on the Texas gas pipeline, we believe, we've talked about that in a brief, that ProAlliance controls all the interstate capacity on that pipeline and about 87% on the Panhandle Eastern pipeline. So they effectively control all the interstate gas coming into the market. And that, quite frankly, is a factual dispute at a minimum.
Well, are primary rights, capacity rights, available to Midwest Service directly from the pipeline?
Well, I think I've just in part answered
in
that.
In part, that's the percentage that you gave me.
Yes, and it could conceivably somebody buy some interstate transport. That is theoretically and practically possible to some extent, but not possible to the extent where it allows a robust competition in the marketplace. We further allege that this combined conduct restricted competitive options for consumers and competitors in the market. essentially what happens is that somebody who wants to buy a product, gas and transportation, interstate transportation, has to go to Pro Alliance to buy that. And either they have to buy that bundled product or try and buy interstate transport from Pro Alliance, and it's very difficult to acquire. And if you can't acquire it, it's very expensive. Now, we attached to our appendix the deposition of David Flogger, who worked at a competitor. And we did that to demonstrate to the court that this antitrust injury is real. It's not hypothetical. He does not work for us. He worked for a competitor, the marketing arm of Duke Energy, which was for most of the period of time involved here owned by Panhandle Eastern. And he testified about the advantages that Pro Alliance has over other marketers. He testified that interstate transport is not available, and that when it is available, it is very expensive, and he gave concrete examples of that. He estimated that Pro Alliance had a 60 to 70% market share in this market for sales of gas and transport to transport-eligible customers.
Let me ask you this. If a marketer had a sufficient number of customers, could it acquire more in terms of primary capacity rights?
You're suggesting that competitor has a substantial amount of business, and I suggest that substantial amount of business can't be created unless they had competitive access to the interstate transport. So it's a chicken and egg kind of thing, and there are no serious competitors to Pro Alliance in the marketplace. Are there competitors? Yes.
Mr. King. Mm-hmm. To the extent that count two of the amended complaint turns on the notion that the formation of Pro Alliance was improper, does the fact that the IURC approved the formation of the Pro Alliance present a problem?
No, because the IURC did not approve the formation of Pro Alliance in the sense they approved the transfer of contracts. There's an Indiana statute under which they were reviewing these contracts, and the issue was whether or not the contracts...
I'm maybe missing something, but doesn't your complaint note that, quote, the joint venture between Indiana Gas and Citizens Gas to form and operate Pro Alliance?
Well, the review at the IURC was a review of the transfer of contracts. I don't know if we're having a semantical problem here or not, but that's what they were looking at, pursuant to Indiana statute, and that is primarily what that hearing was about. And there were very detailed arguments over whether or not there was a merger or whether or not there was a sale of a transfer of assets. So I don't believe so because this court has antitrust jurisdiction, I guess is a short answer, and that court was not looking at antitrust issues. It did not apply the same standards a federal court would on an antitrust analysis.
At any rate, IURC is not regulating Pro Alliance, correct?
Well,
once the approval of the merger took place.
Pro Alliance argued in the IURC proceedings that it was not subject to that body's jurisdiction, and both the IURC and the Indiana Supreme Court agreed. So Pro Alliance as an entity is not subject to their jurisdiction. They were a party to those proceedings for discovery only, as I understand it. In finishing up about Mr. Flogger, he testified about threats that he received both from Indiana Gas and Pro Alliance when he began competing in the market with respect to, he was suggesting to customers to interconnect directly to the interstate pipelines. He was fighting with them at the regulatory proceedings, and Indiana Gas and Pro Alliance threatened to turn down the volumes they were purchasing from him, and they did. We submitted that transcript because under the Forsyth case, it states that we can offer facts by evidentiary submission to show that relief on the complaint is possible, and we believe that his testimony supports this quite clearly on the antitrust injury aspect of the case. Turning to the standing issue, there was a discussion in the briefs about Midwest Gas Storage's standing, and discussion about the 1991 FERC certificate, I believe the transportation certificate that we referenced in our brief, that both parties referenced in the brief, answers that Midwest Gas Storage was authorized to transport gas in and out of its field, and that should handle that issue. I want to discuss the INDEC case briefly. The INDEC case was a Sixth Circuit decision where the plaintiffs were producers of electricity for large industrials, and they sought to develop electrical producing plants for two General Motors facilities. The defendants came along and offered a better deal for 20 General Motors facilities, including the two at issue. The problem with the complaint in INDEC is it didn't allege any harm to either General Motors or any customers in the marketplace. The plaintiffs in INDEC basically complained that they were harmed, but no one else was harmed. So that case is clearly distinguishable from the case we have here. The other issue in INDEC is that there was a comment in that court without citation to any authority that the plaintiffs need to plead an elimination of a superior product or a low-cost alternative in order to establish antitrust standing, and I don't believe that there is any case they cited in that decision from the United States Supreme Court, and that's not the law in this circuit. That case is important as well because it brings to mind the transportation issue, and I want to address that briefly and the cost of transportation. In order to understand the advantage that ProAlliance has in this market, one has to understand, as we put in the complaint, that they received that transportation at little or no cost. Now, ProAlliance has transportation on the interstate pipelines through Indiana Gas and Citizens Gas, supporting its purchases of those contracts. Those contracts cost ProAlliance net about 5 cents a decatherm. The market for that gas is around 32 cents a decatherm. So if somebody wants to compete in the market, that's the price spread they're looking at competing with, because the rate base in Indiana pays for that remaining 27 cents in its reimbursements to Indiana Gas and Citizens Gas. The issue of the state action doctrine was raised, and as this court knows, there need to be two elements present for the state action doctrine to be applicable here. The state must clearly articulate an affirmative policy authorizing the conduct at issue, and the conduct must be actively supervised by the state. There is no clearly articulated policy here. There is no statute that the defendants rely upon authorizing the transfer of the contracts to an unregulated affiliate. There is no statute encouraging the creation of an unregulated market affiliate. There's no statute encouraging the denial of the interconnect or the secondary receipt delivery point. The statute at issue is a broad-based statute that relates to contracts between contracts between utilities and their affiliates generally. There is also no active supervision here. In the IURC looked at this issue in 1996 and issued its opinion in 1997. There has been no supervision since 1997. The Hardy decision decided by this court states that active supervision means that there is some evidence that the industry is really exercising the delegated state authority in committing anti-competitive acts so that the enforcement of antitrust principles would interfere with the state's pursuit of its regulatory policies. There is no indication that this case would interfere with any regulatory policy of the state of Indiana. By way of example, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has guidelines applicable to interstate pipelines and their affiliates. There are no such corresponding guidelines at the IURC. Lastly, the United States Supreme Court in Tycor pointed out that the application of the state action doctrine is disfavored. Lastly, I'd like to address the state law claims. I believe we adequately pled that there was an existence of a business relationship between the plaintiffs and their customers. The defendants knew of those relationships because my clients contacted the defendants, particularly Indiana Gas, to find out about usage data. The defendants interfered with that relationship, and absence of justification and damages were both pled. For those reasons, I ask this court to reverse and remand the district court's decision dismissing the First Amendment complaint.
Thank you, Mr. King. Jekyll.
May it please the Court. This case involves two distinctly different plaintiffs and two different kinds of claims, and it is quite important that those be analyzed separately. The first in time, chronologically, concerns Midwest Gas Storage and the storage field. With respect to that, there are basically two events alleged. The first is that they requested a physical interconnection between Indiana Gas's distribution system and the storage field. The other event alleged is that they asked Indiana Gas to modify or to change its contract with Panhandle Pipeline so as to designate the storage field as a secondary delivery receipt point. On the basis of those two events, there are two claims alleged. The first is count one, which alleges a conspiracy with Panhandle to deny the receipt delivery point designation in violation of Sherman Act Section 1. The other claim is in counts 4 and 5, and it alleges a violation of Sherman Act Section 2, a monopolization claim, by denying access to essential facilities, and that is the denial of both the physical interconnection and the receipt delivery point. Now, our first point on these claims and this plaintiff is, on the face of the complaint, this plaintiff, Midwest Storage, has no standing, no antitrust standing, to assert these or any other antitrust claims in this case. If you look at the complaint, paragraph 42 of the complaint alleges that the relevant market is the transportation and sale of gas to transport-eligible customers in Indiana Gas's service area. Complaint paragraph 42. If you look at Exhibit B to the amended complaint, which is the FERC certificate that authorizes Midwest Gas Storage, a FERC jurisdictional entity, authorizes it to operate. It has authority to operate as a storage field. It does not have authority to transport to end-use customers behind the Indiana Gas or Indiana Gas service area. Now, their comeback on that in the reply brief is to say, well, how about our later FERC certificate, our Part 284 FERC certificate, which they attach in a supplemental appendix to their brief? And our response is, yes, look at that certificate. Supplemental appendix page 24 shows that FERC authorizes them to run a storage field and only that. They are not authorized to do anything else. Now, as our brief explains at page 47, under then-existent FERC policy, they could not have been authorized to transport gas on other people's pipelines, which is necessary to get to the end-use customer. FERC did not allow that at that time. An additional point here is that when you look at the injury alleged in the conspiracy claim, in the essential facilities claim, and even in the formation claim, which Mr. Henneberry will be addressing, what the allegation is that it is what causes the injury is the inability to compete for and profit from the sale of gas. In fact, this is so important, I would like to read the pertinent allegation with respect to count one conspiracy. That's paragraph 50. The allegation is plaintiffs, throwing them together, have been unable to profit from rate 45, 60, or 70, or otherwise compete with Proliance in the sale of natural gas. Plaintiff lost transportation fees and marketing profits they otherwise would have earned had they been permitted to compete for the sale of natural gas. They repeat that in the formation claim, paragraph 54. They repeat it in the essential facilities claim, paragraph 64 and paragraph 70. Well, the fact of the matter is storage cannot sell, is prohibited from selling gas under FERC regulations. And, of course, they don't even allege in the complaint that they can sell gas. So for an independent reason here as well, they can't transport, and they say their injury is caused because they can't compete for the sale of gas. They can't sell gas either. Now, I want also to refer to the substance of these claims, the conspiracy claim and the essential facilities claim, because they also fail on their own terms apart from the standing issue. If you go to the essential facilities claim, the complaint itself actually alleges not that the interconnection was denied, not that the delivery receipt point designation was denied, but that they were offered on terms that Midwest Storage did not like. This is complaint paragraph 18 and 23 on the interconnection, complaint paragraph 31 and 32 on the designation request. Now this, as a matter of law, is not enough for an essential facilities claim. A denial of access for that kind of a claim must make it impossible to compete. In this court's Goldwasser case, cited last year, I think, the complaint alleged a denial of access, there again, an interconnection, on, quote, just and reasonable terms. This court ruled, Judge Wood wrote, that a complaint in the form of X is a monopolist, X didn't help its competitors enter the market, does not, and here I quote, does not state a claim under Section 2.
But let's talk about our opinion in Hamus, which says very clearly that the plaintiff doesn't have to allege all the particulars of its claim in its complaint. You know, we're dealing here with a 12b6 motion to dismiss.
It is correct, Your Honor, that you need not allege all the particulars. But this court ruled to allege an essential facilities claim, you have to allege that you can't compete without it. And I'm to take another example, the Ensley case, the Judge Williams wrote, I think you were on that panel as well, involving the Chicago Skyway and other ways to get in. The court ruled you've got to allege facts from which market power can be inferred. If you don't, your claim is defective under 12b6. And if I could really go on to another point, in this case, in addition to not alleging an essential facility under the law governing that, this complaint goes on to affirmatively negate essential facilities claim. And this court has said time and again, that a party can plead themselves out of court by making allegations showing they're not entitled to relief.
But don't we need some discovery to determine whether the competition was infeasible without the interconnection to the local distribution system and whether the terms offered by the defendant were sufficiently unreasonable? Isn't there a need for discovery? Haven't they pled enough?
Your Honor, they have not. They have not pled enough. But, I mean, they say if they offered it to us, they never say we couldn't use that to compete. I mean, it's simply never said. But what they do say, what they affirmatively allege, complaint paragraph 15 alleges that Storage could access the Indiana gas distribution system either of two ways. Either it could directly interconnect, or it could access through a pipeline connected to the Indiana gas distribution system. Now, complaint paragraph 17 then expressly alleges that Storage completed an interconnection to the Panhandle pipeline in September 1974. It affirmatively negates an interconnection, an essential facilities claim. Now, just a couple more of these, because there really are multiple ones. On the interconnection, complaint paragraph 18 alleges that Indiana Gas knew that the Indiana Regulatory Commission would require the interconnection. So Indiana Gas could not have denied the interconnection by definition. Now, what do they say in the reply brief? They come back and say, well, the United States Supreme Court said otherwise in Otter Tail. That is absolutely, absolutely incorrect. In Otter Tail, the United States Supreme Court held the Federal Power Commission did not have authority to order the wheeling that was involved in that case. This case is exactly the reverse. The complaint alleges the Indiana Commission could have and would have ordered the interconnection. And one more point on the essential facilities claim. Look at the designation of the receipt delivery point under Indiana Gas's own contracts. Now, the designation of a receipt delivery point only is meaningful, only makes sense if somebody comes along and wants to buy capacity release under those Indiana Gas contracts, buy the capacity release, and use that capacity to deliver gas to the storage field. That's the only reason why you need the designation point. Put it in, take it out, receipt delivery. But if a shipper buys release capacity, it has an absolute right, under the law, to designate its own receipt and delivery points. And this is, we quote the FERC order in our brief at pages 25 and 26. I'm sorry, I'm a little concerned. Is the lighting system working here? I have 10 minutes. Mr. Hanaberry has 10.
I'm wondering the same thing.
Okay, so I'm in my spot.
We'll have 2 minutes left.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Are you saying that Mr. Fickle has
So we quote that at page 4. I'm sorry.
That was extraordinarily civil of you.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead.
I just seem like I've been talking a lot. On page pages 25 to 26 of our appellee's briefs, we quote the FERC order, which says, if you're a replacement shipper, you have a right to designate your own release point. Now, one additional point, just which is sort of supplemental here, but it goes to a question Judge Wood asked, is that if a replacement shipper come along, do you have a right to designate your own primary points? And the answer is absolutely yes. And that is in our... that is in the FERC order that's in our appendix, the appellee's appendix at page 18, which is quoting earlier FERC orders. The replacement shipper has a right to designate its own primary point. Now, the other one that we're talking about with storage here, and Mr. Hanaberry will go on, is the conspiracy claim. The conspiracy claim is only the essential facility claim in disguise. It says Indiana Gas didn't volunteer to modify its contract. The conspiracy with Panhandle was superfluous, is irrelevant. Put another way, it couldn't have restrained trade because the party has an absolute right to refuse to change its own contract. Now, what is the? They come back and say, well, the complaint alleges, and you have to accept, that Indiana Gas told storage that Panhandle had to approve on a month-to-month basis. But there's all the difference in the world between saying another party has to agree to a contract change and any one party's ability to say no. The complaint also does not make sense, does not allege a conspiracy to restrain trade for the reason I went up above. I discussed above, which is that a replacement shipper has an absolute right under the law to designate its own point. Made absolutely no difference whether Indiana Gas did this or not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Fickle. Mr. Hanaberry.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Edward Hanaberry for ProLiance Energy. I'd like to address specifically the count two claim relating to the formation of ProLiance, and specifically the claim that formation results or is alleged to be a restraint of trade in violation of Section 1 of the Sherman Act. Now, to augment what's said in the briefing, the reply brief here filed by the plaintiff makes plain and consistent with its complaint that what Midwest is complaining about is, quote, and I'm quoting from page 5 of their brief, instead of releasing that unutilized capacity, meaning the utility's unutilized capacity, Proliance uses it to support its sales in the competitive market, unquote. They further concede that the consolidation of the two utilities' supply portfolios resulted in synergies reducing the firm capacity required to meet the demands of captive consumers and increased the amount of capacity for release in Indiana on a secondary delivery basis. That's at footnote 8 of their brief. What that is saying is that the formation of Proliance created a more efficient competitor in the competitive market, may have caused injury to other marketers, but it's not antitrust injury. That is clearly the rule of Brunswick and Cargill from the U.S. Supreme Court. The reason is because it's not antitrust injury. It's not the kind of injury that ties back to what the alleged antitrust violation is. The Supreme Court made clear, as this court has, that actions that increase competition cannot result in antitrust injury. In this case, we have a more efficient competitor. That is precisely why there is no antitrust injury.
You know, there's an important question to be asked. I'm just going to ask it right now. Did you raise the state action argument below? Midwest says, of course, that you did not, and we need to clear that up before.
Sure. At the time the original motion by Proliance was filed in the district court, the state Supreme Court's ruling had not yet been issued, so it was not included in the original motion by Proliance below. It was after that motion was filed that the state of Indiana Supreme Court affirmed the IORC order and specifically affirmed that was acting within its designated legislative authority. Now, in terms of it being raised or not, of course, it was raised by Midwest. They attached an opinion to their complaint below and stated in their opening brief they did that to show there was no state action. They then argued state action in their opening brief before this court.
Well, have you or have you not forfeited your opportunity then as a basis for dismissing the complaint?
We don't believe so, Your Honor, for the following reasons. First, this court can affirm on any ground that's apparent from the record on a de novo review.
Sure, but
second, they raised the argument. They argued state action in their opening brief. They argued that we were not entitled to it. They specifically argued, for example, the Supreme Court case in Cantor, which, as we showed, was subsequently superseded by the Supreme Court cases cited in our brief in Town of Halley and Southern Motor Carriers. But this is an issue they raised. And it's why they initially attached the mid-level court of appeals opinion from Indiana below that incorporated the IORC order to begin with. And secondly, Ron, I don't think there's any question that this case meets the contours of the state action doctrine following the state of Indiana Supreme Court's affirmance and agreement with the IORC that the formation of ProLiance and specifically the transfer of the contract that they complain of were in the public interest and are continually being supervised. That's my second point for argument. The reply brief does not contest that the IORC, the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, has been given specific authority by the state legislature to regulate the gas utilities in the state of Indiana. And specifically, that body's been given the authority to look to the most efficient use of gas and gas supply to benefit the ratepayers in Indiana.
Are you arguing that they have jurisdiction to adjudicate an antitrust claim?
No, Your Honor. I mean, they are not an antitrust body. No state agency, per se, is an antitrust body.
Okay.
But that's not what the state action doctrine is about. State action doctrine really is really a deference to the state as a sovereign in its regulatory capacity. And what the state action doctrine says under Parker v. Brown is that when a state acts through its regulatory agencies to carry on state purposes, then the federal antitrust laws don't apply if we meet the two tests of MidCal.
Yeah, but whatever relevance the IURC's order might have, it didn't, in any event, purport to decide for all time whether ProLiance might be engaging in anti-competitive behavior.
And that's not our argument either. What we are saying, the important thing about the IURC order under the state action doctrine is that...
You might not be arguing it, but Judge Young cited that as one of the grounds for dismissal. Are you disavowing Judge Young?
No, we are not, Your Honor. Judge Young was perfectly entitled to take into account the administrative contours of the market. This is a regulated market. He's entitled, just as he's entitled to take into account the FERC orders that govern how interstate pipeline capacity is sold and traded and released, he's entitled to take into account the overall market structure as the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission defines in the state of Indiana, and to take into account basic undisputed facts. And again, he's entitled to do that because it was originally raised by the plaintiffs in their complaint. It's part and parcel of the context within which these claims must be examined. The court is not being asked to stick its head in the sand and ignore the regulatory context in which claims are made. In this instance, the importance of the IORC order for purposes of the state action doctrine isn't how they came out on it, one way or the other. It's that they considered all of these issues and still came to a conclusion that in furtherance of the state policy of lowering the costs to ratepayers of Indiana, and that this was a very efficient way of proceeding to do just that in furtherance of their legislative goals, and that these contracts, and specifically the transfer of these contracts to ProLiance, was in the public interest. And the second part of that is they are continuing to supervise that. The effects of ProLiance specifically of the transfer of those contracts are still being reviewed in a present ongoing proceeding, as referenced by the plaintiff. That satisfies both prongs of the MidCal test for application of the state act and doctrine. The transfer of these contracts, keep in mind, lowered the amount of firm capacity that the two utilities independently had to buy. That's an affirmative finding. The plaintiffs conceded. That says that more, not less, capacity has then been made available on the pipeline serving Indiana. It further reduced the cost to be paid by the ratepayers of Indiana. As the state Supreme Court stated in the Gypsum case, taking all that together, IURC was acting within its authority. Now, you don't have to agree or disagree with their competitive analysis, but the point is they considered it, and that is the critical factor. Finally, Your Honor, in the remaining time I have, the whole question of these claims relating to what I call the market power claims. As this Court's made plain, market power means having control of something, specifically the power to reduce output or increase prices. ProLiance, like any other market, does not own the pipelines. Second, as FERC Order 637 makes plain, the regulatory structure set up by FERC, the federal agency responsible for the pipelines, specifically has allowed all types of capacity to be made available in these markets. As Mr. Fickle pointed out in the 637 order attached in the appendix, makes plain that what FERC did in its policy was to increase the types of capacity to be made available, not just one single type. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you so much. Thank you. All right. How much? 3 minutes.
Can you just begin on this essential facilities claim? The point that council made, the Midwest storage is already connected to an interstate pipeline. How does that affect your position?
Well, I think you're in part addressing the standing question, and I'll answer it this way. Indiana Gas refused to, we allege, interconnect and never had an intention to interconnect with us. And they refused to designate us as a secondary receipt delivery point on this contract. Now, that damaged Midwest Gas storage because storage was the party asking for that. In addition, services was damaged because services has standing to complain about the same conduct because they were working hand-in-hand together. Midwest Gas Storage had a storage field that had a pipeline over to the interstate pipeline, and they were going to earn fees on transporting gas in and out of that storage field, storing the gas fees and transportation fees. So they are a competitor because customers can choose to buy gas, bring it in on an interstate pipeline, and put it into the storage field, and that competes with what ProAlliance does, which is to sell the gas whenever during the year, and our alternative is to put it in the field in times when gas is cheap and transportation is cheap. So we are a competitor. So on the standing issue, Midwest Gas Storage is a competitor of ProAlliance, as is services, which they don't contend, because services is directly harmed by the failure to release the interstate transport. And you asked a question, Judge Williams, initially about can't you go out on a pipeline and buy transportation? And I failed to make a distinction for Your Honor that there is a difference, an important difference between primary firm transportation and secondary transportation, secondary firm or interruptible transportation. It's sort of a hierarchy. And what we're complaining about is primarily is this primary firm transportation because that's what customers want. When it's cold outside, they want to get the gas to the plant or the hospital or whatever. And primary firm is a great marketing point for them. If you want service, we can provide it because we're the only ones that have the primary firm into the marketplace.
Mr. King, you just have a minute, but I would like you to respond to Mr. Henneberry's response to my question about the state action argument.
I think I addressed that in my opening remarks in that there is no affirmative state policy that the state of Indiana has articulated authorizing the conduct that we are complaining of, not just the transfer of
power. Did they waive or not?
I did not take a position on that in my briefs, and I defer to the court on that, quite frankly. They did not raise it affirmatively in the trial court, I don't believe. We did raise it in our opening brief. Let me wrap up by simply saying that what we have here is a factual factual dispute over whether or not they provided a more robust market by the creation of this pro-alliance. We contend they did not. Opposite is true. They're on the other side of it. That's something that's not subject to a motion to dismiss. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you very much. Another really well-argued appeal. Thank you to all, and the case will be taken under advisement.